You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. And welcome to episode 330. And in this one, I chat with Dr. Amita Jassy. Amita is a consultant clinical psychologist at the National and Specialist OCD, BDD and Related Disorder Service for Children and Young People at the South London and Maudsley NHS Trust. So in this one, we break the podcast down into two parts. One is adapting OCD treatment for people with ASD, and ASD stands for Autism Spectrum Disorder. And the second part of the podcast is dedicated to BDD. And BDD stands for Body Dysmorphic Disorder. We discuss her therapy story, adapting OCD therapy for people with ASD. She breaks down what is ASD, how rigid thinking in ASD can impact treatment, bringing in special interests into therapy, tracking feelings without the use of a 0 to 10 scale, disentangling what is OCD versus what is ASD in terms of symptoms, how the family members can help their loved one with autism and OCD. We then change topics to BDD and we discuss what is it, the lack of insight in BDD, where BDD comes from, the unrealistic expectations or representations of beauty in the media, the therapy for BDD, ERP for BDD and how it differs from ERP for OCD, bringing in compassion and much, much more. I enjoyed both these topics, both topics that I haven't covered a great deal on the podcast. It's great to be able to shed some more light on them. And it was a pleasure chatting with Amita. And thank you to NoCD for supporting the podcast. NoCD offers affordable, effective and convenient therapy available in the US and outside the US. To find out more about NoCD, their therapy plans, if they currently take your insurance or to download their free app, head over to go.treatmyocd.com/theOCDstories, or the link will be in the episode description. And thank you to you guys. As always, I deeply appreciate it. And without further ado, here is Amita. Welcome to the show, Amita.
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you here. So whenever I get a therapist on or psychologist, I like to kind of understand why they became a therapist or psychologist, and in particular then why they work with, in your case, OCD, BDD and people on the spectrum.
Really good question. And now I'm going to have to dig into my memory of many, many years and then go sort of letting people know my age now. I think I've always been fascinated with people, and just, you know, from a really young age, always been very observant and curious and so forth. And if I'm completely honest, I kind of fell into this in terms of just following my interests. So at university, I actually took up sociology first and did sort of minor in psychology. And I thought, oh, actually, prefer the psychology bit. Did a placement, thought, oh, yes, see what clinical psychologists do. And that was it, really. I'm just really fascinated, you know, by the job and just, yeah, as a therapist. But I guess particularly with the clinical psychology bit, you know, sort of get all the research and all of that. And then sort of what's fascinating about kind of OCD and body dysmorphic disorder and all of those conditions is, yeah, I guess, you know, we all can relate to different aspects of things. And I've just found that quite interesting to think about sort of when people have obsessive compulsive disorder, just the sort of impact that can have and sort of habits and thoughts that we all have, sort of where it then tips into disorder. But I think, yeah, I find it really interesting. It's such a varied condition, both OCD and BDD, and we'll be thinking about that in the context of autism. And it's just, yeah, it's just fascinating. It's just worked in it for years. There's always something new to find out. No two people are the same. I mean, that goes across all of the conditions we work with. But yeah, OCD is just really varied, really interesting, but treatment works, and that, I guess, keeps me going. You know, that you see really good outcomes. Yeah, it kind of works in the same way for most people. And yeah, we still have a bit more to learn. So yeah, a bit of a mix of everything.
Good point. Nice. I like it. So, you know, you've written, I'm going to show you, but no one else can see this. And obviously, you know it because it's your book. You recently wrote Challenging OCD in Young People with ASD. And it's a book aimed at practitioners and therapists.
Yeah.
It's a step-by-step kind of week-by-week guide. It's really good. So any therapist listening, I do recommend it. But I really want to go into, I didn't say before the podcast, the audience is probably primarily people with OCD. There's also a lot of family members and sort of a growing clinician base that listen. But just for those that don't have or aren't diagnosed autistic and maybe don't understand it, how would you describe ASD to someone?
Yeah, really good question. And I think, again, like I was talking about OCD being so varied, it's the same with autism spectrum disorder. You know, I guess the spectrum bit gives that away that, you know, it can be really varied. And yeah, some people could be really impaired. So it affects sort of social communication, sort of interacting with people. There's lots of people with autism have repetitive behaviours, which that's where it becomes really interesting with OCD, thinking about what is kind of part of OCD and what's autism and kind of really restrictive kind of interests. And with it being on spectrum, you know, some people could be really impaired by it. So really sort of struggle to function and get on with day-to-day life. So find, you know, that they find social interactions really difficult and struggle with that. And then, you know, some people are mildly impaired, so can actually sort of get on with most things. But, you know, sometimes it's hard to understand other people's emotions, or kind of they may want particular routines and so forth. So a real spectrum that can affect sort of is particularly around socializing and sort of social communication.
Yeah, thank you. And with rigid thinking that can occur, how does that affect OCD treatment?
It's a really good question. People do kind of vary, as you know, with autism, but yeah, rigid thinking is something that we find quite a lot. And I think what we find is that sometimes in when we're trying to challenge OCD, it can make it a bit more difficult, because I guess when people, you know, with OCD have these thoughts and worries, you know, they can feel really real and they get stuck. And that's what happens in OCD. And then people feel they have to do rituals or compulsions to get rid of it. And I guess in my experience, when young people have, and I keep referring to young people because I work in a young person service, but this goes for adults as well. I guess sometimes in people who have autism and then they have OCD on top of that, those thoughts can get particularly stuck. And so in therapy, when you're trying to challenge that or kind of trying to think about alternative ways of thinking, that can be a bit harder for people with autism because they can get quite stuck in sort of that thinking. However, when it's sort of people do come to treatment and they get some alternative ways and try to change it, it can completely go the other way as well. So then they can actually get better and kind of see that alternative. But yeah, it does make treatment, you know, it works, but it can just be a bit more challenging in that respect.
Yeah, okay, makes sense. And most of my listeners will be very familiar with CBT and exposure and response prevention therapy. But what are some ways that you would adapt that form of therapy for someone with autism?
Yeah, so we, in our clinic, for people without autism, sort of the standard package we do is 14 weekly sessions. And for autism, we do 20 as kind of standard. Of course, there's variations with that. And the reason we extend is at the beginning of treatment, if it's good treatment, you get a period of psychoeducation where you're learning about OCD, learning about obsessions, compulsions, learning about anxiety and how that works. And what we find for people with autism is they need a bit longer to understand that information, but I guess particularly around understanding emotions, so understanding what anxiety is, how it feels in their body, how to rate that can be a bit challenging, and for people with autism, and also understanding how that's different to other emotions. So the treatment, we adapt that to allow more time to help people understand kind of the difference between emotions and understand how to rate them. And then with the exposure part, my experience is that takes a little bit longer as well, because we find that we have to break things down into smaller steps, because actually distress and tolerating that distress can be quite tricky in people with autism, in that it's harder because often they're quite, they find that more difficult to kind of tolerate. So we might break down their hierarchies and the exposures into smaller steps. Mm. And I guess what I also find is ensuring that the tasks that you're doing, they're really concrete, applicable to day-to-day life. Because one of the things people with autism, again, I'm making generalizations, this isn't for everyone, but they do struggle to maybe what they're doing in sessions sort of then apply it outside of sessions. So generalizing learning can be tricky. So trying to do exposure in the environments where OCD gets triggered, asking parents and carers and family members to support with exposure tasks outside of sessions to support that sort of generalizing of learning is something that we find is really helpful. So yeah, just a few of the more broader modifications, but of course everybody is individual and we might require different modifications on top of that.
Yeah, thank you. And I think in the book, around kind of showing how they're feeling, I think you use the traffic light system.
Yeah. And actually that doesn't work for everyone. So in the book, we've given a few examples of how people can rate their anxiety. So, you know, typically we use a 0 to 10 scale. And, you know, actually I find that a bit difficult. Sometimes trying to put numbers on feelings, it's hard. So I think for autistic people, some people with autism can do that, some don't. So in the book, in the treatment manual, we talk a lot about adapting sort of the rating scales for people. So some people with autism do like the traffic light system, some people don't like that. So another tip we have to therapists is maybe, you know, incorporating special interests. So with one person I worked with, we did kind of Doctor Who kind of scale, with Doctor Who being like a 0 and the Daleks being like a 10 in if we were to translate that into numbers. So that's a good way of engaging people, but just whatever works for them. And I think in one of the most extreme examples where we've just simply, you know, the person, somebody I work with, couldn't rate anxiety, we actually use an external way of measuring that. So now, you know, we, you know, all have these watches, don't we, or kind of devices where we can look at heart rate and things. So kind of using an external measure is quite helpful if it's just they find it really difficult to rate. But I think the main thing is just they've got a way to communicate, you know, how distressing that things are, and have a sense of that feeling, like that reduces when they do a task, and that the more they do it, it gets easier. So as long as those principles are held on to, any way of kind of measuring that and communicating that is helpful.
Yeah, I like that. And a lot of the things you've mentioned, we could flip that and be like, so my question is kind of what hinders treatment? And obviously a lot of what you've said, if we flipped it, we've kind of got the answer. But if there's anything else you wanted to share around that?
Yeah, I think one thing clinicians do struggle with, and people that have OCD and autism, is trying to disentangle what is the ASD bit and what's the OCD bit. And I think particularly, as I sort of mentioned a bit earlier, around repetitive behaviours versus compulsions. And I have to say, and I think in the manual, from what I remember, we've sort of put a bit of a Venn diagram, because there are things like compulsions are more sort of anxiety driven, they're driven by fear, and sort of repetitive behaviours in ASD tend to be kind of a bit more enjoyable kind of habits. But there is a grey area where it's like, actually it could be a bit of both, or we're just not sure. So that can be sort of tricky, because I guess it's, you know, we have to try and be as clear as possible, you know, what we're tackling, because there's some, you know, repetitive behaviours can be sort of challenged and shaped. But I guess in OCD, you're trying to focus on the OCD. So I think that can be tricky and it can get confusing at times. And I hold my hands up and say, actually, you know, there's been times where I've quite not got it right, because I think it is just, it's hard. So I think that can sort of hinder treatment. And then I guess what you mentioned earlier, just the kind of the rigid thinking. So, you know, if people are a bit amenable to kind of thinking about alternatives, it can work really well. And then actually sometimes people do just flip the other way, like, oh wow, there's another way of thinking, and really go with it. But I guess some people with autism might struggle with sort of their insight into their OCD, and that then can make it a bit challenging. But then sort of my way around that is just trying to think about functional goals and sort of trying to support somebody to try and get to what they want to be doing as a way to sort of just work through that. But it's not easy. And often in our service, whether you've got autism or not, it's the families bringing their child to services. And then you have that sort of challenge as well that they might not see it's a problem. So, yeah, they're some of the challenges.
Yeah, thank you for that. And earlier you mentioned distress intolerance. And for me, if I think about ERP, I'm thinking the goal is to be able to tolerate any discomfort that comes up as kind of an experience that someone's having and kind of ride it out. And if that then becomes the issue, how do you work with, I know you said you break it down, the exposures. Is there anything else if someone's really still resisting, even because I've had this where I've really broken down exposures and it just felt like that's still not enough?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Something in the clinic we sort of over the years been going back and forth on. And I think what we do find with people with autism is sometimes their baseline anxiety is really high. And therefore, then when you're doing exposure, it just takes it higher and it's really unmanageable. So we've talked a lot about in the clinic, and even if their baseline's not high, just maybe giving them some tools to try and bring their anxiety to a more tolerable level. But bearing in mind what I think, I'm slightly hesitant when I say that, because what we don't want to do in ERP is give the message that you have to do something to bring your anxiety down, because that's exactly how OCD works, doesn't it? You sort of get an obsession, it makes you anxious, and you have to do compulsion. I think particularly people with autism, they might get into the habit of, I always have to do my breathing exercise, I always have to do a distraction. Yeah, yeah. So what we might do is introduce some of these techniques to sort of give them a sense that actually I can cope with this, but with the view that once they've got going, you might start to reduce some of those techniques as their confidence builds up, because what we don't want is that to become sort of compulsions. But there is quite a lot of work with Tony Atwood and so forth, which I think I do refer to in the therapist manual, where there are other techniques like the emotional toolbox and other things to be scaffolding people with autism outside of the OCD and outside of treatment to sort of support them more generally. And some of those tools can be then brought into therapy. Because I think, there's probably a bit more that we need to do to support people with autism and OCD.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. And how can families support someone with autism and OCD? I've done several episodes on specifically families and how they can help reduce accommodation, all of that stuff. Is there any extra adaptations that need to be done at home?
Yeah, I think sort of my experience, and I don't know if, again, I'm just skewed view because of I work with young people, but I think we do rely more on family members with people with autism to be co-therapists. So probably sort of lean a bit more on them because of the kind of issues, as I was raised, about sort of generalising and trying to apply sort of principles from therapy to outside of therapy. So we sort of pull people, you know, family members in probably more so than we would with people without autism. Of course, all of the above, like you said, kind of, you know, with family accommodation, but we probably rely on them a bit more in terms of, can you help set up the exposure tasks? Can you help sort of remind and also sort of help really involve with them in therapy in terms of, okay, how is this at home and how can we sort of apply this at home? I think that's the biggest thing. But I think also, even in the psychoeducation, we probably rely on a lot more sort of reporting from families to help us understand that, because maybe, you know, not all people, but, you know, some people with autism might struggle to report what's going on if they lack insight and so forth. So we might sort of rely on sort of family members with that. So I guess in answer to your question, kind of the support is probably more about implementing the therapy and probably lean more on families to kind of do more of that than we would perhaps with people without autism.
Yeah, thank you. That's interesting. And I want to move on to body dysmorphic disorder in a second.
Yeah.
But before that, is there anything else you want to say on this topic?
Yeah, I guess, you know, we know, and this is why you're doing the podcast, that, you know, there is a real high rates of comorbidity between OCD and autism. And I think there are maybe some beliefs being held that, you know, people with autism, you know, can't do the treatment, or if they've got OCD, you know, it's harder. And I'm not to say it's not hard older, but there are sort of modifications and adaptations, and people do get better from OCD, you know, even when they have autism as well. So I think, you know, I kind of say that from a position of having worked in this field for years and seeing people through treatment, but I guess it's that sort of hope that I wanted to share that, you know, I think it is hard. I think OCD treatment is hard anyway. It's not the most pleasant treatment. It's challenging. But I do worry sometimes that with the added dimension of autism, people think, oh, well, you can never get better. And people come into the clinic and say that, like, it's just about getting a bit of your functioning back. And it's like, no, actually, you know, part of the work, and like you asked earlier, what's kept me in this job is, it is about sort of, well, we can adapt this treatment. It can be modified and people do get better. So I guess that's just a hopeful message to share with listeners.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you for sharing it. So let's move on to BDD, body dysmorphic disorder. And it's not something I've covered a great deal on the podcast. I made a conscious choice early on. I realized how much was to cover around OCD alone. So I kind of, that was my niche and that was where I was focusing. BDD is actually something I experienced as a young kid. And to be honest, some of my darkest moments, I think, were as a result of that more so than OCD, even though OCD's kind of stuck around longer for me. So why I'm sharing this is, if anyone is predominantly affected by BDD or in any way, there is a great podcast out there on BDD, which you've probably been on maybe. It's out of the UK. I'll put a link in the show notes to anyone that wants to check that out. So BDD, what is it? How would you describe it?
So BDD, body dysmorphic disorders, is far less known about compared to OCD. You know, you say OCD and most people know what that is. But with BDD, it is related to OCD. There's lots of similarities, but lots of differences. And somebody who's got BDD gets really preoccupied with what they perceive as a flaw or flaws in their appearance. It can be anything. It could be any part of sort of their appearance. And but other people would look at that and kind of think, oh, it's only tiny, or they just wouldn't notice sort of that person, whatever that person says is kind of they're worried about as a flaw. It would appear slight or just non-existent to others. So it's kind of perception of the sufferer. And what that then leads on to, and this is where it does become quite similar to OCD, is because of that preoccupation and those worries about sort of appearance, sufferers then engage in lots of repetitive behaviours to try and fix or hide that flaw. So doing grooming, kind of routines, trying to camouflage with makeup or clothes, trying to, like, lots of avoidance. They might avoid social situations, so forth, sort of checking mirrors or avoiding mirrors. I mean, the list could go on. Just like with OCD, there's a long list. And I guess what is different and what's concerning, I guess, with OCD, with body dysmorphic disorder, is that often sufferers, you know, do feel so low that we unfortunately hear and find in our service that people have higher risk, so more thoughts of suicide, and actually sort of try to make attempts on their life, which is incredibly sad, and also sort of high levels of self-harm and so forth. And, you know, OCD is often sort of referred to as the hidden or the secret sort of disorder, but actually I would say BDD more so. So what we find with BDD is, because the preoccupation is about physical appearance, so I think there's something wrong with my nose, my skin, you know, people talk about their penis or their, you know it can be anything. Because of the nature of their preoccupation, they're going elsewhere to kind of get the fix. So they're going to their GP, they're going to dermatologists, they're going to cosmetic surgeons, because the preoccupations around the physical appearance. So the kind of the worrying thing is that we're not getting them through to mental health services, and it's a mental health condition, because people think, well, because it's about, there's a flaw in my appearance, so I need to fix it, so like I'll go to those places.
Yeah, interesting. I went to the BDD conference in 2016 in London, and I think Professor David Veal was saying that they want to get or maybe it was Rob Wilson, wanted to get a screening tool for plastic surgeons and stuff, and people that give Botox, and before kind of giving the cosmetic, just to screen if there's any sort of difficulty here. The other thing that Yeah, I mean, you very much shared it there. But the thing I've always wrestled with BDD, it could very much feel like, for me, in my personal experience, it felt like OCD at the time. It had the same sort of weird worries that didn't really, in hindsight, have any grounding in reality. And then it had the ritualistic compulsions. I was very anxious. There was shame, guilt, all of that stuff there. The main, and in clients I've worked with, I very much feel like sometimes it feels just like a subtype, like contamination, religion, relationship. But the big difference, at least for me, was the insight.
Yeah.
So with OCD, I've always had, there's always been a slight part of me that's felt like this is ridiculous, even though I was very anxious. And I know OCD varies in insight for people, but with BDD, it was very much, no, I'm a freak. There was no like, and I think that's what I'm glad you said about maybe there's a higher rate of suicide or suicidal thinking.
Yeah.
For me, that's what I felt.
Yeah, yeah, I'm really sorry to hear that. That's, and it's a really common, yeah, really common story. And I think you're completely right. It's the insight, because it's about, I think, like you said, there's different degrees of insight in OCD, but most people kind of know that it's unreasonable or it's excessive. So I guess with BDD, we find that most people have more sort of delusional insight or poor insight. So they actually do see the flaw. And in therapy, when we ask people to do kind of a self-portrait at the beginning, so we could get a real sense of what they see, it's astounding, because when I see and what they see is completely different. But actually, when they look in the mirror, they can see that. And we know perception is so interesting. Yeah. Perception is so influenced by how we feel about ourselves. People see things in different ways. There's so many different things. So it's a genuine, people see that. And it's, we never, in therapy and when we're doing assessments, there's never a discussion of, but I don't see it, you know, because that it's just that's, they see what they see. Yeah. And, you know, we honour that. And, you know, that is, you know, that's what they see. There's just no question of that. I guess in treatment, what we really focus on is actually the distress and the interference that's kind of having on that person, on the sufferer. Yeah. And that's a bit we can agree on in therapy. It's like, okay, so you see what you see. Can we agree this is causing distress? Can we agree this is impacting on your life? And that's where the hooking comes in therapy. Yeah. But try and work on that bit. But it's an incredibly, incredibly distressing illness. Yeah, it does feel different in that way to OCD. I mean, OCD is distressing, but it's the insight that I think is the bit that really feels different.
Yeah, and I hesitate to maybe share this, but when I was in training, one of the guest lecturers that came in was talking about the difference between OCD and BDD, and she said predominantly the main thing is the insight. At least that was her view. And she said where OCD is categorized as sort of neurosis, to use that horrible term, BDD is almost touching on psychosis. It's not psychosis in any way, to not trigger people, but there's that, because of the extreme lack of insight, it's almost bordering on. And as you said there, that I saw things in the mirror, you know, I believed, but it's not a hallucination. It's not a delusion. That's where I want to be clear. But it is weird. It feels like you're very much seeing. So it's hard to describe what it is, you know?
Yeah. But, you know, we all do that. I could look in the mirror in the morning and feel, you know, a bit different by the evening and actually see things there. And actually, if, you know, what we get people to do in therapy, and I, you know, do it as well, it's like if we really focus in, like on the top of our hand, for example, and really like just spend ages looking and looking and looking, you end up noticing things that you wouldn't. And actually your perception of like your hand changes, you know, because that's part of what happens in BDD, is there's lots of kind of processes that are happening, such as kind of selective attention, sort of focused attention. And it's like, you know, you do end up seeing things that you didn't see there. So if you're kind of focusing in on these flaws, then they are real, you know, you can actually see them with your eyes. And in therapy at the beginning, we do lots of things around sort of optical illusions, that, you know, making the point that we could both look at something and see the old woman or the young woman with a, you know, everybody knows that one, And there's one where you kind of, they're squares, and if you stare at it long enough, these grey dots kind of start appearing between. But they're not there. But if you stare long enough, they just appear. So I think it's about understanding we all have different perceptions, and that actually when you do zoom in on things, of course, perception changes. Yeah. And then throw in your feelings and your self-esteem and experiences. And, you know, we know lots of people that we work with have had kind of people commenting and bullying, you know, or making comments about appearance. Throw all that in for good measure. And of course, what you see is what you see. It makes complete sense.
Absolutely. And do you see that in a lot of your clients with BDD or patients with BDD, that it was triggered by some sort of bullying or event, or was it more just like sometimes OCDs just come out of the blue?
Yeah, so a real mix. And in fact, we're doing a study on this at the moment to look at people's clinical notes, because, you know, the part of some of, for some people, some of what the therapy we might be doing is drawing on some PTSD techniques where there have been, you know, bullying incidents and kind of people commenting negatively. But actually, it's quite interesting because we're comparing OCD and BDD, and this is hot off the press. In fact, we haven't looked at it properly, but I was looking at some notes and actually found no difference just looking at sort of, we've just looked at 100 people between OCD and BDD that actually, in terms of trauma events, there doesn't seem to be a difference in kind of number or type. So it really does vary, I guess, similarly to OCD, you know, people have really different roots in, and, you know, we think there's the biological bit, the genetic bit, and then there is the psychosocial bit. And actually, I've worked with some people where they haven't had like bullying or trauma experiences, but something about the importance of appearance has been fed through to them in some way. So actually, somebody I worked with years ago, actually, it was just people making positive comments about their appearance growing up and in the family, you know, just talk about appearance quite a lot. And so that then led to a belief in that person that appearance is important, and they hooked quite a lot of their self-worth and self-esteem on that. But, you know, that's, it's different for everyone, but it's interesting in sort of thinking about sort of the roots in, I guess, like OCD, we probably never know. But the treatment's the same. So it kind of works.
Exactly. And on that client you just said there, it makes sense if I'm getting all this admiration and all this love, well, if I suddenly become ugly, whatever that word means, doing air quotes, people can't see, then no wonder I'm afraid, you know, because if something happens to me, then I'm, who am I? And I guess the other thing that comes to my mind there is culture at large. There is a lot of pressure on whatever beauty is, you know.
Yeah, there's been a real shift in gear, hasn't there, with social media. And I guess lots of people do ask that question, like, does social media cause BDD? And it's, no, it doesn't. But we can't ignore, you know, the cultural context or just being bombarded with really unrealistic images, you know, airbrushed, filtered, you know, images with social media, with it being accessible 24 hours. I think if you have BDD or vulnerable to that, that's going to kind of fuel the fire. So that's kind of where I'm at with my understanding of sort of the influence, that in no way can we say it causes BDD. It's much more complicated than that. However, if you have it, you have access to, you know, platforms 24 hours a day. If, you know, one thing people with BDD often do is compare. And so then you can do that all the time, and you're compared to unrealistic sort of images and pictures of everybody's filtering. So there's quite a lot of work with the BDD Foundation. So I'm a trustee of the foundation, and there's lots of work being done at the moment with, you know, people on their website saying this is a filtered image, and this is, you know, just to be clear so that people understand, you know, that what you're comparing to isn't realistic. Not to say it doesn't, you know, people still will compare and so forth, but just labeling it and saying actually these are unfair comparisons.
Absolutely. And even if the image they're looking at isn't doctored or edited, the person has most likely selected one out of 20 pictures they took that was the one that was the most flattering. You know, so they're not picking the one where their face is a bit blurry or they don't look quite right or the light's not hitting them, and so it's edited, I guess, in some way, whether directly or
definitely. Nobody's going to post unflattering pictures, just like people don't generally post, you know, it's all the good times that they're having generally. So if you're depressed, you know, and you're looking at your friend's Facebook posts and, oh, their life is so great. You know, some people do post kind of, you know, things that aren't going well, but on the whole, it's an unfair comparison, isn't it? Because it's, it, like you said, even that's quite selected and kind of filtered.
Yeah, true. Absolutely. So you said that obviously the treatment is the same for BDD as OCD. But how does it look different, or how would you apply ERP to someone struggling with BDD?
Yeah, so I made that comment and I was like, oh no, I sort of, yeah, it's not exactly the same. There's some components that are. So we know sort of cognitive behavior therapy is, you know, the one, the most evidence-based treatment, and with or without medication. And there is an element of exposure with the response prevention. Mm. And so that is important. So again, sort of with the kind of rituals where there is an anxiety component to it, like, you know, checking the mirror, it's similar in terms of trying to resist that kind of urge to check the mirror. Mm. However, having worked in both, and I've worked in OCD longer than BDD, it's quite interesting then sort of, you know, now treating BDD. What I'm noticing is that, you know, there's lots of other components that we add to the treatment. So you mentioned earlier, you know, there's other emotions that come with BDD. Not to say that doesn't have with OCD, kind of the shame, embarrassment and so forth. But, you know, lots of people describe a lot of shame in BDD and kind of disgust and so forth. And so those feelings, if you're doing exposure, they don't habituate in the same way as anxiety. So we might sort of draw upon and do more work around sort of behavioral experiments. So testing out some of these beliefs around if they didn't do X, Y, and Z, what do they think would happen, and kind of testing that out. David Beale and many of us do lots of work on sort of compassion, sort of focused therapy, and sort of weaving that into the CBT and sort of self-compassion and work on self-esteem as well. Because, yeah, this is often sort of a symptom of that. And also a lot of the work we do is around sort of trying to build up their life, and that life is more than sort of appearance and building up other things. But I guess what happens with BDD, it becomes so focused on appearance, it's sort of trying to rebuild some of the other things that were going on. But yeah, ERP is a really important component, and that's where it's really similar to OCD. But we're learning a lot more about BDD treatment. We've got, you know, we've just actually published a paper in Young People to find that 79% respond to CBT with ERP as a big component of that. But I think I'm slightly hesitant, as you probably picked up in that, I think we've still got a lot to learn, because that, you know, people are still doing lots of different things. And I think what we're not sort of sure is exactly what are the key sort of component. We know exposure is, but we're still learning. People might disagree. I think if David or Robert are listening, who've been around in this field a lot longer, they're like, oh no, we know. But I think for young people, I'm probably talking more about that. We're still trying to develop some treatment packages. For example, I'm working on developing packages for people with autism and BDD, because those don't exist yet. So so I think it's definitely, ERP is really important, but yeah, lots of other ingredients to support that as well in BDD treatment.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned compassion, because I was going to ask you about CFT, because I know David Villon recently has become a big fan of it, at least from what I gather. And so what sort of, Are you sort of following a CFT protocol? Is it more just bringing aspects of CFT alongside the CBT?
Yeah, I think probably the latter. And what we're sort of doing in the clinic at the moment is a few of us are going on training and trying to think about how we bring that in and for who. So I think with OCD, we sort of have a sense of all the subgroups. And I think for BDD, we're trying to understand kind of, you know, it's not one size fits all, and we're trying to understand kind of subgroups. So, you know, we have a subgroup that definitely is driven by perfectionism, but that's not for everyone. So we're thinking, what would we do with people who have that sort of aspect, and sort of that more, I think everybody needs more CFT sort of approach, because very self-critical and kind of harsh on themselves. So I think it's probably more the latter. We're sort of pulling that across, but I think we could do more. So we're trying to understand a bit more. We're learning, sort of learning on the job, as most of us do, trying to sort of develop treatments as we're doing them is the best way, and getting feedback from the people receiving treatment. But yeah, I think David definitely is an advocate for that and is at the forefront of a lot of the research BVD, so helping us think about that.
Cool. Yeah, that's really good to hear. And yeah, whenever I use CFT, it's pretty much always around someone's inner critic.
Yes.
And I can imagine with, well, I kind of know with BDD, at least from my own experience, there was that voice that's constantly in my ear of like, you're not good enough, or this is wrong, or which may or may not be the inner critic, but I can imagine compassion would very much help with that.
Definitely.
Yeah. Cool. So I think that was all my BDD questions. But yeah, anyone that wants to go much more in depth into BDD, I'll link to that other podcast. So I guess around OCD, ASD, or BDD, how has your view of treatment changed over the last 5 years, or your approach of how you are as a therapist?
It's a really good question. It's interesting because I think I've started, so I lead the BDD service within our service now, and I still do OCD work. So I guess that's really influenced kind of my views in terms of just augmenting and sort of enhancing what we, you know, the exposure-based approaches. So I'm quite sort of hardcore behaviorist. I think it's because I work with young people, and we know the more behavioral approach, ERP, you know, works really well for young people. And I think having worked with OCD and autism probably longer than actually just OCD, because I started working with people with that comorbidity first, I've just seen lots of, you know, really good outcomes with that. Not to say, you know, we don't sort of add other bits in. And I think now I've started to work much more in BDD, as well as OCD, as I said, I think I'm learning a lot more about trying to augment and add things in to the treatment, but with the view that that would enable somebody to be able to then take those risks to do something different, which I think then ultimately helps challenge some of their beliefs about themselves, or kind of the OCD thoughts, or their beliefs about or worries about their appearance. So yeah, it's been quite an interesting experience. So I still believe in exposure-based treatments, but I now have learned, I think, through my work about there's different ways to support people to get to do that work. And perhaps more, I'm finding with BDD, they might just need other techniques to support them to do the exposure, to get them there. So I would say that's how my sort of thinking and work has probably changed.
Okay, nice. So much more sort of scaffolding.
Yeah,
that's a
good way to describe it. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, I like that. If you could pick up the phone and call the 20-year-old you, what would you tell her?
That's a really good question.
These are the hardest questions.
And also, I'm having to think back a long time. I would say just keep doing what you're doing. I sort of, this is where, you know, I was around 20 when I became really interested in psychology and clinical psychology. I think, yeah, I would just say just follow your interests, you know, I think, and also just hold the values, you know, just keep hold your values, which I hope I've done. I think I've done. Which, you know, for me, it sounds so cheesy that I just wanted to help people. And I think, you know, I was thinking about social work and all of that. And I think, yeah, sort of just I've held on to that, I think, which has been nice because it's hard sometimes in the pressures of the work that we do and things, and just holding that true. So, yeah, I think I would just reiterate that. But I feel kind of proud sitting here, I won't say how many years later from being 20, that I think, you know, it's wavered, you know, there's been challenges. But yeah, I think it still stays at the heart of everything that I'm doing still, is just trying to sort of help people. Yeah. And I'm just very lucky that I've ended up landing a job where I'm really excited, interested in sort of what I do, and that we don't know it all yet. I think I think the sort of curious child in me still is there, that if I lost that curiosity and that want to do things differently and learn, it'd be such a shame. So I'm very lucky in that respect.
Absolutely. I think it's good that you have the research component to your job, because yeah. it does keep it fresh, I guess.
So, and you can sort of, I think a lot of my research, the whole ASD, OCD stuff and now BDD is, you know, sitting in the clinic, you know, with young people sitting there and like, oh, actually, you know, a lot of the hunches, or you meet a few young people, like, oh, there's a bit of a pattern here. And then to have that luxury or the resource to then go away and look at that and look at that across lots of people and collaborate and and then share that with other people is really, you know, I'm in such a fortunate position. But yeah, definitely, it's, I think I'm really lucky with my research. It's all clinically driven, and I get to then what I see in the clinic, get to go and test it and then bring it back. And that's the main thing, and kind of share that with sort of the people I'm working with.
Yeah, I mean, that's really exciting. It's not like fully detached, you're, as you say, you're very much the research is completely entangled with the actual treatment. You've got a billboard in London. What do you want written on that billboard?
Oh my goodness, these questions are brilliant. I got really worried there. I was like, do I have a billboard in London? It's just like, it's a bit scary. What would I want written on there? Oh, that is such a good question. I don't want to sort of just repeat, but kind of almost like, I'm here to help, I'm here to learn, you know. I think that's the thing as well, just to remember that we're all learning. And I think when people come to therapy, I never want them, I never want to give that impression like I know it all, I've got it all down, because I don't think any of us are. We're all humans, we're all on a journey, we're all learning. So yeah, here to help, but still got lots to learn. And I learn so much day in, day out from the young people and families I work with, and in the manual, the OCD manual, I've said that actually they're the people I want to thank, because they're the ones that have taught me what I know, and then helped me sort of share that.
Brilliant. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that quote, something like, the more I learn, the less I know.
Yeah, exactly. Ignorance is bliss, I say quite a lot. Like, sometimes actually it's better not to know, so, because it's just, but then it's not always bliss, because then just be really bored. But
that's true. So lastly, is there anything else you wish you could have shared today, generally, or ASD and OCD or BDD?
I think just with BDD, I guess it's similar to the OCD ASD comment, just, you know, I think there is hope in terms of, you know, treatments are really improving all the time, and you know, which is really exciting. I guess the thing I would like to say about BDD is, you know, it's just as common as OCD. So we think around 2% of the population have it, yet, you know, we're a specialist BDD clinic, and we don't see as many, you know, people with BDD coming through compared to OCD. Yeah. And it's been interesting, OCD's gone through the roof, the referrals, in the context of the pandemic. So we've had a 40% increase in people come through with OCD. But I know there's just as many people out there with BDD. So it's really hidden. So if anybody, you know, has noticed some of those things that we describe, you know, where somebody is quite preoccupied, they're talking about it a lot and they're sort of distressed, maybe just have a look online, because they might have BDD. But yeah, I think that's the biggest thing I would share, that it's just as common and we see much less of it in mental health services. So lots of work to do on that front.
Yeah, I mean, I barely see it in my private practice. OCD I get all the time, and it's not even because of the podcast. The people I get don't listen to my podcast, they're local. Which I'm kind of glad about, because I reveal too much on the podcast. I don't really get any BDD, and maybe there's the shame there that stops people coming forward.
And they're going to the, you know, the GP and so forth, and it's misdiagnosed a lot, so often as depression or social anxiety. So when they do get to services, people are missing it. In the other podcast and on the BDD Foundation website, there's some screening questions, just really simple questions to just ask. And if you don't ask, you'll never find out. And actually what we've learned is, if you ask some simple questions, like, do you worry about your appearance? Are you having to do things? Is it causing stress? People do actually share. It's just, we're missing it. I think they do come through in different ways. We're missing it. I've missed it over many years. And now I look back, I think, I'm sure they had BDD. I think we've got lots of way, we've got a long way to go, I think, with
Yeah, fair enough. But yeah, room for improvement everywhere, and
definitely,
you know, the research should help. So yeah, lastly, thank you so much for coming on, sharing your expertise. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip / donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. And thank you to NoCD for supporting our work. If you want to find out more about NoCD, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.